welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Well, Bill.
Yes, Aaron. We're here.
Don't make me start coughing.
Okay,
don't
sorry.
Do it. There might be coughing today. Sorry. Might just be a little tiny bit of coughing. So let's see. We're going to air this show live on February 2nd, 2025. Probably roll it again at some point in time. So if the political references seem odd, you just go with it. Like, we aired some Christmas stuff in January, and I'm sure people were like, hello, time travelers. Santa was already here.
Wonder if this is a rerun.
Yeah, no kidding. So just wanted to say the inauguration was really fun, even though we didn't really get to attend exactly. Everyone was in the city. But I will tell you, it was kind of amazing. My flight headed back there. There was a woman sitting next to me from Fiji, at which point I had to admit I didn't know Fiji had its own language. Wasn't totally sure where it was. And, you know, didn't know the metric system because she wanted me to tell her what the temperature was in Washington at centigrade. I was like, I'm American, one language, no metric, you know. So she laughed and we chatted. It turned out ultimately she was there with four friends, and they were, some of them were still working, some were retired, but they were airline stewardesses from Fiji Airlines. And they had gone as a group to pray for the president and for his success, because Fiji is a mess and they want him to fix their country too. And I thought, wow, you fly all the way from Fiji to pray for our president so that hopefully some of it rubs off on your country. I thought that's kind of great. And then throughout the week, it was Uber drivers, people in restaurants, just all over the place. And you think, oh, Washington, D.C., you know, it's some liberal hell. And everybody's going to, all the people who work there, you know, the regular working people, not the Capitol Hill people, but the working people, they're all going to be Democrats. It was really interesting. They knew we were there for the inauguration because, you know, wearing pins and looking like dorks and stuff, you know, the usual.
Conventioners.
Well, mostly under our giant parkas, because it was like the one day we went to see the Lincoln Memorial was like 4 degrees or something. But they were really funny. It was almost like look left, look right, and then get the whisper voice on. And they would say, we're really excited. We're really excited about the new administration. It's like, really? Yeah. Yeah. We think it's going to be great. It's going to make such a big difference. And I just was shocked at the variety. Old people, young people, men, women, really didn't matter. It was really quite something. But, I don't know, not attending the inauguration was almost as fun as being there. Went up into one of the office buildings on the hill, and when the cannons went off, we could hear them out the window. That was fun. The really bad part was, though, when Joe Biden flew away, we raced to the end of the hallway to go see the helicopter take off, and then we realized there was like a little delay in the broadcast thing, and like it already left. So we took pictures of the tree that it was behind and then sent it to our families. But other than that, actually, it was pretty neat. I was surprised at how orderly everything was. The whole place was really locked down. It was terribly difficult to get around. Not as many people as you would have thought, because people canceled their, you know, their flights and all jazz. But
you had a great picture of the mall there with 4 inches ice on the ground.
Yeah, people all skating on the reflecting pond, like. It was neat.
Frozen, yeah.
And so for anybody who says, oh, they could have held it anyway, I have this great picture of the Washington Monument and all the grass in front of it. And there were tickets for that area. That was a ticketed standing viewing area, even though it's really, really, really far. But there would have been, I think it was like 150,000 people in that particular section. It had, I don't know, I didn't measure it, but about 3 inches of ice. They were hitting it with sledgehammers and it wasn't breaking, and trying to get the fencing out of it. So, and it's on a slope, so that would have been just like one big human bowling pile with everybody at the bottom.
At the bottom.
There's just, it was, so it wasn't so much that it was like the blizzard conditions, because people said, oh, well, it was nice enough. It was just cold. Yeah, it was just cold, but you have to remember that it was just raining and then it was just frozen. So there just were problems. And actually, it went off just fine. Nobody seemed to be too upset about the whole thing. And all the people who got tickets to the event will get them and have them for souvenirs. So, I don't know, kind of a weird way to do it. But It was best it could be. Went into the Capitol afterwards and just always shocked at how many people from all around the world are there to see our nation's capital and looking at all of our history and all of that. So if you haven't ever been to Washington, D.C., maybe don't go when a million people are slated to show up. But, you know, go and look at all of that if you've never seen it, because it's really, really impressive. So there are people in Congress and people who've made laws over time that we all don't like and we don't always love the policy and all that. But the place and the history is amazing. And definitely put the Library of Congress on your deal. It sounds boring, like a giant room with a bunch of books. And I've seen books before, been in libraries before. That building is spectacular. It's kind of like a little miniature, very miniature, trip through Rome. It's beautiful. The architecture is beautiful. Everything about it inside is spectacular. So schedule yourself a little trip. And then when you get back, you can be thrilled that you're no longer on the metro. You're no longer crammed in any hotel room, and you're no longer looking just at concrete. So for those of us who live in rural America, it was a joy to get home, especially since we flew out 5 days before the plane crashed. That was a little weird as well.
Yeah.
So there's my recap. There's my recap on the inauguration. But seriously, if anybody wants pictures of different things or would like more information, just get a hold of us. We're right there on the website at wethepeopleradio.us. And how about Nathan? Do we have Nathan with us? Nathan, how's it going, buddy?
Pretty good.
Good, he's in there. So you guys are in Montana, no strangers to the cold and the winter. And I always give your bio. Why don't you tell? We just did that a couple weeks ago. And hey, by the way, that show we did with you on AI and the power consumption and the Tower of Babel and all that, it's linked on this day in today's show. But you should really, really. If you haven't heard that program, you should go back and listen to the first hour with Nathan. It was really interesting. And I guarantee you, you haven't thought of it that way before with all the AI stuff. So, Nathan, you're in Montana. You raise feeder calves in central Montana. But you moved, right? Or moving a little bit?
Yeah, just not too far. Moved to where I grew up. It's only about 50 miles down the road. So, no, it's a move, but it's not too major of a relocation.
We moved 3 miles and it was like we thought we were going to die. It went on forever. We thought we'd be smart. We'll just like put it in the truck and we'll just take stuff down there and then call the movers for the big stuff. Yeah. So we moved every day for like 30 days. Don't do that, Nathan. Don't do it.
Just, yeah, move it in one whack.
We'll do one shot. Yeah.
God.
What a nightmare. Yeah. So you're background and things. Tell folks a little about that. It's interesting.
Yeah, I guess I can give a little brief on my background. I, like you said, Nathan Deshmaker from Montana, born and raised here, central Montana, pretty much the heart of the state between Lewistown and Grass Range, and been raised on a cattle ranch. Family raises cattle, and left the ranch for a while earlier on in my life, and had the opportunity at that point to study quite a bit. I wasn't in college. I was in a college town, Bozeman, but was working relatively full time and studied a lot of theology at the time. Was pretty involved in some small groups and just personal study with history and law. Never really studied much when I was in school. Took later on to get exposed to some other classical literature and things that I never really was introduced to. And that, so that was the early days for me of starting to read and study our heritage and our history. And part of that, I started to realize that I really had taken for granted where I was raised and in the context of all of that understanding inheritance and different things, and started to go back and help out on the ranch more. And in that series of events, my stepfather, who's north of Winnet, east of us, that's where I moved from here recently, but he had a terminal brain tumor, went through a surgery and did well for another about seven, eight, 9 months and ultimately passed away. So that thrusted me back to that to run that estate for several years. And we were out there for 10 years, raised, registered, started out just Angus, and then shifted over and with my brother and dad raising registered Piedmontese feeder calves. And in that transition, where I grew up was all deeded and private lands, and out there, my stepfather's place had a lot of BLM allotments and federal leases, and BLM is the Bureau of Land Management. So about half of the place, land-wise, was federal land. So that was a new dynamic to step into and take that on. 10 years out there, like I said, just moved back to where I grew up, still in the cattle business, but shifting a little bit in that respect. And while I was out in Winnet, I, you know, with my prior studies, I kind of, coming onto the ranch and starting to deal with, you know, the place was going through adjudication with the state water court and other things, so I had to traverse all that stuff. So I shifted, my study focus shifted a little bit, and at the same time, a non-governmental organization came into the region, and before I came, about 10 years before, but was really active when I showed up, buying out a lot of ranch land. So I, with my background of studying our heritage and our laws and our history and what our founders laid up for us in our government, I started getting involved with local governments and county commissioners and seeing how we could engage in the federal rulemaking process and regulations and permitting so that our local people, our local taxpaying citizens and property owners are represented at the local level and not some outside special interest foundation or agency. So just in a nutshell, a brief in that respect, that was the beginning of my work in the policy arena and government type process, and long story short, just engaged over the years in that process, and the Lord really opened up some neat doors of good relationships nationally and in other states that I've had the opportunity to work with experts in various fields and around the property rights arena. And so just a real blessing, because that gave me tremendous shortcuts to understand process and how to engage with these agencies. And so in summary, a couple years ago, I brought online a for-profit business, Montana-based LLC, in which I provide consultancy and advisory to counties and coalitions of counties or associations or individual property owners to help them traverse the federal agency processes and bring accountability into that. And we've been overall pretty successful, so that's been pretty encouraging.
Yeah, because that was kind of the focus today, was some of the things that you guys had done that had gone well, because depending on where you live in the country, especially if you live in the rural parts of the country, like, for instance, we've had massive fires in Southern California. We're, of course, having a monsoon today up here in the 12 hours north of them.
Soon to be followed by massive fires.
Yeah, right. Well, they took out our dams, so imminently to be followed by massive flooding, actually, which will be really enjoyable since, you know, all the environmentalists who want that sort of thing don't live here, so it won't affect them, of course, yet again. But interestingly enough, the cattle ranchers and the farmers and all that north of us on a couple of rivers, they are still under drought conditions. The governor has still got them under emergency drought so they can take their water and...
He's like, just looking ahead.
Yeah, and feel good about it, I guess. So they're still under emergency drought while we're having, you know, torrential rain, and they refuse to create any new storage here. But the other day, Mr. Newsom decided that we should probably not let all the water run out to the ocean. We should probably save some.
Yeah.
Yeah, during the rain.
It's just sad we don't have a lot of places to save it, because
it's just sad somebody had to say that out loud, that wouldn't already be our policy, right?
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's just, I don't know. So we're living in crazy town, but we need people like you because fighting them is really, really complicated. So for all the folks out there who either know somebody or are somebody who is trying to get a grip on the morass of policy that seems to keep going the wrong direction, I think you'll like today. And I think Nathan will give you some valuable intel. We will get into that in 2 seconds when we come back from our break, actually. I should do like I do with the dogs. It's always 5 seconds. We'll be back in 5 seconds. So you are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
All I do is drive, drive, drive. Try to stay alive and keep my mind on my load. Keep my eye upon the road. I got nothing in common with any man who's home every day at 5. All I do is drive, 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 drive. If I can get the fuel.
Keep what I earn, to decide what my kids learn. What I consume shouldn't be the lawman's concern. To be free, speak my mind, to believe as I'm inclined. Without Big Brother driving by.
Yes, we should keep Big Brother as far away as possible, unless he's really your big brother, in which case you should invite him over for holidays and stuff.
Nice analogy.
Don't shake your head at me, Bill. I've been sick. All right, Nathan, where do you want to begin?
Well, I guess there's a few things we can discuss. I guess first I would just comment on your comments before the break in relationship to California water, because I think there's some principles there that are systemic. Some states are just as bad or worse than the federal government, but the federal government is often on that same trajectory. G.K. Chesterton said a century ago that anytime you take down a fence, you ought to pause long enough to ask why it was put there in the first place. And we have a whole bunch of people like Newsom and all these swivel chair experts in bureaucratic offices that think they can just rip dams out and remove fences and remove long-established policy and regulations that provide for free market economy. And there's no consequences to those things. We can just go ahead and do it. And so the California situation, and it's not just there. There's other places. Where, you know, up here in the American Prairie Reserve region where they're buying out ranches, they want to remove all the interior fencing. They want to remove stock water reservoirs. And in the original congressional laws, that, prioritized stock water reservoirs, the purpose wasn't just for stock water. It was for reducing siltation into the Missouri River watershed for all the barges downstream, down to the Gulf all the way through, and it was also to provide impoundments of water for rural fire response. So as these NGOs buy lands and remove those reservoirs, it's a smaller context than California, not as big a reservoirs, but still, when you remove those and then you have a fire raging through the prairie in your backyard and your tender truck runs out of water and the dam is not there, you no longer have a source to refuel your tender truck and provide the water you need to mitigate that fire. So those are examples all over. And somehow people have gotten into policy positions and federal agencies have become so, you know, powerful in one respect that they can somehow, that or their special interest NGOs, push these agendas that are, and they're really de-development agendas. We have multi-decades and centuries of American citizens and people building the infrastructure needed to make civilization possible in a market economy. And they want to dismantle that for some reason. And there's, as we're seeing all around us, there's consequences to those efforts.
Well, the other piece of it that, you know, I have this conversation with people a lot, two-pronged. In California, it's an excellent example of what happens when you institute term limits on your state legislature. You put your state bureaucracy in charge of your state. They're there for 30 years, but your elected people are there for 12. And at some point, they decide, you know, well, I really don't care what you guys say because you're not going to be there long enough to hurt us. And you don't have any historical knowledge, so you really can't go after us because you don't really know how the whole thing works. But we do because we've been here the whole time. So if you think that elections are not your term limits and you want some artificial thing put on, take a look at how that has worked out here. And the other piece of it is, now that President Trump is in office, people want him to come and fix that in California. Now, I definitely want all these things fixed. But if he can sweep in and override the state and fix things, next guy can like sweep in and override the state and break things. You know, the door swings both ways. And so, you know, we have to be a little bit careful what we wish for, because there are a lot of states that function really well and don't want the federal government involved.
That's how we got into a lot of this, is we started depending on the federal government for so many things, and we got used to getting the free money, and now we're kind of home.
Yeah.
You know, we have to learn to get by without it.
Well, it's kind of like, come in and save us, right? We have elected bad people who are doing bad things to us, so now we have somebody in the federal government we think is our ally, so now we expect them to come in, and, you know, it's like, well, we have the 10th Amendment and all that stuff. So, I don't know, what do you see across the country on that front? Is there a push toward, let's put more federal in charge of bad states? Or is it just here?
Well, I think, you know,
I'd just be here.
I think there is some of that in like states that are in California's position. And you actually bring up a really good point about the term limit deal. And I'm not going to speak necessarily to the term limits themselves, but that ties into this. And you contrast it with the term limits with an expert administrative state.
Yep.
And the swivel chair folks that are there for long term. So Montana is not as nearly in as bad a shape politically as California, and we have Republican-dominated state at the executive level in every major office, and then pretty good control in the House and Senate on the Republican side as well. But even with those majorities and those seats, we still have a systemic issue with. And Montana does have term limits in the state of Montana for legislative office. And there's still, because that's what I recommended new legislators, and my representative is first, they're in session right now. And, you know, and they go up there and they get, you know, just overloaded with, you know, literally there's thousands of bill drafts of everybody has their bill, and the bill drafters, the lobbyists, and the governor's office is just pushing all of this onto the legislature. And you have a lot of legislators that are conservative, well-principled, pretty connected sometimes with our principles of good government, and but they're just overran in that whole process. And there's a ton of opportunity in these legislative hearings that go through the process of bringing these laws into the books in Montana for the exploitation of that ignorance, where it's not the legislators' fault themselves. They just, like you said, they don't have all information and knowledge, and the entrenched bureaucracy, even in a Republican state, still has a lot of sway in driving law and policy, and some of it's decent, some of it's not so decent, and so it's a systemic issue in that context, I think, throughout the whole country, where, you know, I honestly think there shouldn't be any legislation allowed to come to the governor's desk unless legislators write it. That would solve a big amount of our issues right there, because you'd weed out, and it's not that we don't need bill drafters in some contexts, but Very few legislators actually draft their own bills and do the homework on the laws to draft. And really, honestly, we probably don't need new or more laws. We need to maybe undo some of the, you know. Justice Joseph Story said that what are all the codes and the voluminous laws that disgrace our code books, but monuments of deficient wisdom. And that was 1833, Supreme Court Justice Joseph Story, appointed by the architect of the Constitution, James Madison. Monuments of deficient wisdom. So we need to undo some of that deficient wisdom, take away, you know, we always talk about the deep state at the federal level and the bureaucracy, but there's a lot of bureaucracy in our states as well. In Montana, you mentioned the federal government coming in and saving the day. That's not happening in Montana necessarily because, you know, we have a lot better policy than California in many respects. But our state is still cost-sharing huge amounts of dollars, especially in land acquisition and conservation easement programs. And what happens when a state starts to take federal monies and inject that into their local budgets at the state or county levels? It's very difficult to remove those dollars, and in the long run, it subordinates the states to the federal government. So that's not a good trajectory to go in, because the whole basis of preserving our constitutional republic is to have distinct Republican states that are sovereign and are individual units that can exercise that sovereignty within the framework of the federal constitution to protect the individual citizens. And if you subordinate yourself as a state to the federal government through all these programs, you lose that independence or aggregates of that independence as you go down that pathway.
Well, it's funny, too, because the other piece of the puzzle is when people have a problem with whatever program that's funded by the federal government, they call their federal office holders and want them to look into it. Well, the problem is the program is run by the state. But it's a federal program. Yeah, I know, but the money goes to the state. It's run by the state. So they don't even have direct direct oversight on it once that money is allocated. So
yeah, so where's the money go? Does it do what it was designed to do?
A lot of times the accountability kind of goes away, and then you look at the duplication. What we have EPA, we have federal EPA, we have state EPA, we have federal this, state this, you know. Do you guys have that in Montana, the replication of all the federal agencies at the state level?
Yeah, I think most states to one degree or another do.
Yeah, and then we added California Air Resources Board just to double down and really get some bad stuff going on.
Yeah. Well, there's, in some states are worse than others. You know, and no offense to California, Washington, some of these states, I've never done much work in California per se, but have done work in Washington state on grizzly bear issues and some different items. And, I've often said to a couple of friends I work with over there is, you know, really, back to you saying, you know, the federal government comes in to save the day, that's what I keep saying, is the federal government shouldn't be bailing these states out, and maybe sometimes, maybe the voting people in those states would, maybe not, but maybe the power structure would change if the consequence of their actions would be fully felt. And if they're able to be bailed out through subsidies, because that's how California and Washington function. They brag through these climate agendas they're pushing to transition to net zero and all this stuff that they're building their GDP and they're outperforming non-member states like Montana and Wyoming and other states that aren't going that pathway. But they don't tell you that all that GDP increase and all that economic growth is a result of injection of billions of dollars of federal subsidies. So it's not a real wealth creation.
No.
It's a subsidized wealth creation. You hire short-term jobs and people to build wind farms and put up solar panels and take out dams.
Yeah, no
kidding. And then you have situation, back to the first principle, when you take down a fence, you should pause long enough to ask why it was put there in the first place. And so in policy, that's really, you know, my approach is – because bureaucracy and federal laws, regulation is a diluted, complex mess oftentimes. But, you know, my approach is always you start with first principles and really common sense. And you contrast those first principles with the efforts of government. And in my case, I try to help, you know, I do things independently sometimes through my business, but primarily I try to help county governments because government, local governments in particular, have a tremendous amount of power in those processes, government to government. And if you direct language and those first principles into the process in a targeted fashion that's very substantive, it immediately changes the dynamics. Because federal agencies in particular, even state agencies, but federal agencies aren't used to that. They're used to getting hammered by the environmental lobby and all this stuff, but they're not used to local government stepping up to the plate and saying, if you're going to push this program through our county or through our state, you're going to fight us every step of the way.
See, and I know that there are counties around the country and always here in California that would like to fight that. It seems to be a it just is so big. They don't have the skill set to do it, and they often don't have the money to make that happen. So between those two things, they tilt at the windmill until they run out of steam. Or they just don't try at all. I'm not really seeing a whole lot of in between, but it's very difficult to push back. How are you helping? Actually, I guess we probably have to take a quick break before I give you this giant question. But when we come back, maybe, like, can you answer this in 20 seconds? I was thinking, like, maybe you could, if you go to a county, you know, a county comes to you and says, hey, you know, the federal government wants us to do blah, 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 or this agency wants us to. How do you help them spin it up so that a county with a normal county budget, which is low, and if they have a big budget, they have a lot of people, so it's still low per capita. How do they do that without having to, you know, get rid of their sheriff's department and break the bank? Because that truly is the, I don't know, that's like the magic. If you've got the magic, Nathan's got the magic. We're going to tell everybody. Nathan's got the magic. He's going to tell us all about it in 5 seconds, and we'll be right back. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. For the magic.
For the magic.
Deep in the heart of Texas, back in 1835, they drew a line in the sand. The folks at Gonzales had freedom on their minds. It was all because of a cannon that had kept their colony safe. But then General Santa Anna sent some Mexican troops to take the big gun away. You know what those colonists said? Come and take it if you want it. Come and take it if you think you can. Come and take it, but we'll warn you. You'll have to pry from our cold dead hands. We want the freedom that God gave us, so you best not cross that line. If you want this gun, you gotta come to us and take it. One shot at a time.
Compliance. We just need your compliance. You will feel no pain anymore, no more defiance. We just need your compliance. Just give us your compliance. We won't let you feel lost anymore, no more self-reliance.
Yeah, all that messy self-reliance. That's a lot of work, but it's worth it. All right, Nathan, the magic. You're a small county. You're being beset. You want to fight back?
Yeah.
That was the dot right there. Like,
yeah, dot. Yeah, well, that's a good. It's a good question, and it's a. It can be difficult sometimes. You know, I personally. in the sphere of influence that I've been able to work in have taken that to one extent or another upon myself, of making that a priority, and didn't really plan that in my studies. I wasn't planning to become a person that helps counties engage in anything like I do. So for me personally, it started out of, and that's really how I approach county commissioners and just associations and people I work with too, is really comes down to duty. If you have something coming in that has significant impacts on your county, you're resource limited. As you say, you don't have a lot of resources available. You know, what do you do? You know, and what I did personally with some of the counties I started working with regionally is I went in and sat down with them and spent the afternoon, and didn't just go in like most people and say, here's all the problems and I expect you to do something about it. I laid down some issues and problems, and then I studied their land use policy and looked at the authorities, the agencies, the BLM in this case was were supposed to be following, and put some things forward and said, here's some problems, here's your guys' authorities, and if I can, I'll do what I can to help you apply it and put it forward. In a couple counties, initially, where I initially was, I was somewhat sidelined by my own county commissioner. I went, or not commissioner, but commission. They were super resource limited county. There was only like 600 people in that county. So it's all ag, all cattle, but not a large tax base. Pretty thin margins. And I even offered to help on some items just pro bono and went nowhere. And I went home and was kind of discouraged, like, well, what do you do if the ones that have the authority to bring these things forward don't want to do anything? And I got a phone call from a senator on the High Line that said, got on the phone and said, what do we do to stop them? And that was, you know, God's way of telling me, well, I need to. So I started going to other counties and working with them. So, you know, from a personal perspective, in answering your question, you know, it was really a lot of sweat equity to start with, for me personally, and just caring about the issues and caring about property rights and the loss of free market economy and alternatives within our rural counties. Because as these rules, regulations, land acquisition programs all unravel, in the long run, that doesn't, as you're saying, a lot of these counties are already on thin margins. When you take away more of their resources and the taxable industries from those local jurisdictions, it's not helping the county. So that's actually a really important point in answering the question as well, is that's actually one of the ways we combat the programs, is bringing, in a very substantive fashion, awareness and bringing that to the table, that we really just force the agency to answer to those issues of how those actions are going to affect the socioeconomic environment, the culture, the customs. And in rural counties in Montana, like a lot of states across the West, those customs and cultures of ag and mining and timber and other resource-based industries are multi-generationally established by families and people in those industries.
We're seeing that here too, is that it isn't like people started farming that ground, you know, 15 years ago, or started raising cattle there in the last, you know, 35 years. This has been going on for a very, very long time. And the more we, and again, you know, we are the example of examples. The more you mess up the way your land policy is done on your public land, the more you suddenly see, you know, the result of it, like fire. You take away the grazing, you take away the timber management, so you put all the loggers out of business, you put the miners out of business, you decommissioned the roads, you made the land inaccessible. Worse yet, maybe you made it a wilderness area or something like that, so you really can't fight fire. Then you get rid of the places that hold water, that make it available to fight fire. I think the really the end of our... like if you were going to end the story, you know, if you were doing a movie and you're like, God, we got to land the plane here. Let's just be done with the movie. The way you would have ended our movie is you would have banned the red stuff, the fire retardant.
Fire retardant.
They tried to ban fire retardant, and that would have been like, and the end. We couldn't have. I mean, you can't get around that. No water, no fire retardant? Really? No logging, no mining, no grazing, no. It's like, okay, we're just going to wait till it all burns down. And then the mudslides come, and so it isn't just burning. There's consequence after all of that. And I don't know if that the country realizes how much money they're pumping into places like this to backfill what the state can't handle to rebuild places that, in a lot of cases, probably shouldn't have burned down in the first place. Like, people should care about this. You know, they go, oh, those idiots in California. I'm like, yeah, well, you're paying the bills, so, you know, who's the idiot?
Exactly. Well, and it's a lot easier to tear down than it is to build.
Well, see, that's the thing. People say, well, Trump gets in office, we'll build those dams back. I'm like, yeah, no.
Yeah, well, that's, people forget that Trump in the first 4 years and his agencies lost almost 80% of the APA cases, the Administrative Procedures Act cases brought against him. So there's some hurdles for the Trump administration to get over, for sure. In many respects. And that's back to the importance of local citizenry and local governmental involvement, is back to the question of resource limited. What do you do? First off, you need leaders in the county or in the state that recognize when you protect your people, you protect the state and the county. So there's a duty to represent and protect the actual taxpaying citizens that live in your jurisdiction. And I love the word jurisdiction because it comes from two Latin words. Juris is law and diction is to speak or to dictate. And I use this analogy in breaking that word down oftentimes for counties, because counties' jurisdiction is within a geographical boundary, or just like a state. There's borders that constitute your jurisdiction. So within those boundaries, you have the authority to speak the law. So, and when you empower your local magistrates, commissioners or elected officials, with the language and the first principles of law and good government, and to speak those things, it's a very powerful thing. But the other side of that coin is, if you don't speak the law, you're not exercising your jurisdiction. If you're just sitting in an office and checking every paper that comes across your desk and signing checks, I mean, that's part of your responsibility. But exercising jurisdiction is a broader function than just administrative service.
Sure. And that makes sense.
It's government to government as well.
The other difficulty comes, though, when people want them to be more powerful than they are. Back to jurisdiction again, you know.
Yeah.
Well, the state said we have to do this and that. You need to go tell them no. It's like, well, it's kind of more complicated than that. What's the mechanism for that? Like, when the state rolls in and says, well, the water, you know, the Department of Water Resources says, you know, this is still a drought and blah, 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 blah. You still have to fight the nuts and the bolts of that. I mean, there's no fast answer to that, is there? If there is, just tell us now.
Well, it's not an easy answer. And that's another problem. That's another difficulty in getting local government engagement, too, is it's leaders aren't going to engage if they don't understand their position and their authority, and they are comfortable with. And that's true of me, too. You're not going to hear me speak with authority on something that I haven't convinced myself of first.
Sure.
The tough task is the educational and training side of it. And sometimes you have good county commissioners or good legislators that have already done a lot of the homework, and you just come alongside them. Some of them you need to bring up to speed. So that's another difficulty. It's not just resource limited with financial side of things, but there's, you know, where are those bright lines of authority? What authority do we have? How can we bring that forward? And sometimes the answer is, when an agency comes in and says, we're going to do this, sometimes the answer is, no, you can't. But you don't just say, no, you can't do that.
Right.
You point to the governing authority, because our system, there's a hierarchy of authority within the constitutional republic our founders established. You have the Constitution, that's the law of the land. Then subsequent to the Constitution, you have the Congress, under Article 1, has the power to legislate and draft law pursuant to the Constitution. So you have Constitution, congressional law, and then below that you have the Code of Federal Regulations, which is regulatory. And then below that you get down to the policy manuals, the memorandums, the guidance, et cetera.
That's like how the laws all hit the ground.
Exactly. So your local field office people and your Forest Service, BLM, or water departments, most of those local folks that are implementing quote-unquote the law aren't functioning from the organic statutory authority that actually gives them the regulatory authority and power. They're looking at policy manuals, guidance documents, and memorandum that's passed down through the bureaucracy to them, and then they bring those things forward. So that's one of the ways in which you combat that is we essentially, in some cases, slide those policy manuals to the side of the table and redirect the agency back to its organic mission as laid out in the congressional law. And that saves a lot of time right off the bat because with that hierarchy of authority, the closer you go to the source of authority, the less complex and the more simple and the shorter the language. The farther you get away from the hierarchy of authority and the first principles of government, the more complex, the more diluted, and the more language is involved. So we, instead of scouring all this bureaucratic language through regulation, policy, memorandum, and et cetera, I mean, we look at those things, but we only look at those things to see where they're aligning with the hierarchy of authority and the Code of Federal Regulations and the statutes and the Constitution.
Yeah. Show me the law that allows you to make this rule.
Exactly.
Bottom line, you know, because there has to be a law that allows them to make the rule.
So here's the other side of that coin. A lot of times an agency will come in and point at a law, say, we're going to do this, 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 and this, and here's a statute from the National Environmental Policy Act that gives us the authority, and they cite two references from that body of law. But there's something in law called the doctrine of in pari materia, which is Latin for all like-kind statutes are to be interpreted as a whole. In other words, you can't cherry-pick one statute and form a whole agenda based on that. So sometimes it's, even if they can show the law, we analyze the whole body of that law and say, we either say either you can't do this, or if you're going to do this based on those authorities you're citing, we cite the other authorities that are pertinent to that law and other laws that are associated and say, you first have to do this, 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 and this. So we feed them their own bureaucracy. And that doesn't happen either because they're used to showing up to a local government, citing a federal statute, and most local governments sit back and say, they're the federal government, what do we do? There's the authority. So what we do is apply the doctrine of in pari materia. And by the way, an analogy of this, that's exactly what Jesus Christ did in the Gospels when he was taken out into the wilderness for 40 days, 40 nights and fasted, and then Satan came and tempted him. Satan said, turn this stone into bread, and he cited a statute from Deuteronomy that gave him the authority to do it. Did Jesus put his hands up in the air and say, oh, you got me, there's the law?
Okay, I guess I'll do it, yeah.
No, he applied the doctrine of in pari materia and cited another statute from Deuteronomy and said, man shall not live by bread alone, but every word that proceedeth from the mouth of God. There was three temptations Satan brought to Jesus in those instances, and he brought it with statute from the Old Testament every time, justifying the actions. And every time Jesus countered it with the doctrine of in pari materia and the counter statutes within the law, to shut it down. So in a practical context, that's one of the tools and one of the things we apply in helping local governments challenge higher power is when they come in and cherry-pick a statute, we understand the rest of that body of law, and we bring those other authorities to the table.
But bottom line is, even Jesus had to know the rules.
Exactly, but like I said, the closer you get to first principles, the easier. See, in the ancient world,
uh-oh, Hold on. We're going to the ancient world. We're going to call it the news, though. We have to come right back. We're going to keep talking to Nathan, though. So you can mull that over, and we will return. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us. Second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And today is February the 2nd, 2025. We are here with Nathan Deshmaker. And I'll tell you, Nathan is full of ideas, and he always comes at things from a perspective that I don't know. Nathan, you still catch me off guard. We were just kind of chatting with our engineer during the news break there, and we both were just like, what the heck? Go back to the devil tempting Jesus. Do that one more time, just in case somebody just... Because we were like, wait, what? I'm still discussing with people about the Tower of Babel from, like, back on January 5th when we first talked to you. Like, still ruminating on that, but do that part over again.
Well, that's so. When I say first principles, those are the things I'm talking about. The first principles of good government and law, and you see that organically in our original compact in the Constitution. So, with the Jesus analogy in the Gospels, we are talking about agencies saying we're going to do this and citing a statute that gives them the authority to do it. And a lot of times a local official, that's the federal government, there's the law, we can't do anything about that. So in the Gospels where Jesus was fasted 40 days, 40 nights in the wilderness, and then Satan came and tempted him, all three temptations presented to Jesus Christ were presented from an authoritative basis. Turn this stone into bread, cited a statute from Deuteronomy that gave him the authority to do it. And Jesus didn't put his hands up and say, oh, you got me. He went into the rest of the body of the law and cited another passage from Deuteronomy, man shall not live by bread alone, but every word that proceeded from the mouth of God. And that sequence followed throughout that whole passage and in those three temptations. And those three temptations was the world, the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. But that's what Jesus did in that is he applied what's called in law the doctrine of impera materia, which is Latin for all like kind statutes are to be interpreted as a whole. You can't take a Bible verse and rip it out of its context and create a whole doctrine out of that. It is a unit. And it's the same thing with our laws. Our founding fathers happened to be Christian men, predominantly, and were very well versed in the systemic nature of comparative law and first principles. And no matter how well something sounds, when it breaks with the first principle, it's not good. There's nothing wrong with turning a stone. I mean, Jesus, God in the flesh. What's wrong with turning a stone into bread and satisfying your hunger after not eating for 40 days? What's wrong with that in that context, in that situation, is that it broke from the first principle of the Lord being first, serving the will of his Father. Because Satan was ultimately offering a shortcut to what he already had, or what appeared to be a shortcut. But anyways, with that said, it's just an analogy I often use in the context of how we engage from a local governmental perspective against agencies.
But it's a super good example. I mean, it's a super good example. And so it, I guess what that really screams is this is not a new idea. This issue has been with us for a long time. We've always had somebody who wanted to tell us to do things the wrong way, and a lot of times we're just not good at fighting back.
Yeah, well, and it's so the burden on free people is we have to know the law. Mm-hmm. One of the royal governors in the royal governor in New York in colonial America, there's a letter he wrote to the king at one point, and he said, "I cannot dupe these Americans because they are all lawyers." And what he was, it doesn't mean they were all experts in bureaucratic law. He was referring to the fact that they were so well established in the first principles of law and government and knew their Bibles and were armed. It was very difficult to dupe them through all the mechanisms available through the crown and through the British framework that was ruling in the colonies at the time. And our founding fathers did not push some kind of anarchist anti-law agenda against the crown in England. They actually reached back just like Jesus did, except for they weren't pointing necessarily straight to the scriptures. They went back to Magna Carta, the English Bill of Rights, the English Constitution. That's why some historians have said our founders were more English than the English. They were actually pulling from the organic first principles of common law laid out in over multi-centuries, and reasserted those first principles. And that's why when you read the Declaration of Independence and Constitution, it's pretty overall, especially the Declaration of Independence, it's not this 500-page document. It's concise, straight to the point, understandable. And that's what I was getting to right before the break, is in the ancient world, and it's true today, the power structures always used complex language and legal systems to control individuals and the masses of the people. The Egyptian system of hieroglyphics was highly complex, and only a priest class within that system understood and wielded the power of that language and the law structure. Same thing with the Chinese the Chinese characters, the ancient Chinese language is very similar. When the Ten Commandments came on the stage through the nation of Israel and Moses, it introduced the law in a 23-letter alphabet a child can understand within Ten Commandments, with all the case law broken down from those 10 first principles. So historically, in the history of the world, that's a revolutionary reality, because what that does is it frees the individual and gives them a reference point to challenge higher powers in the earth. And that's all through history, and that's been part of my study, is studying that phenomenon. Nobodies with no resources triumphing against the powers. I mean, it's David versus Goliath. The problem is today is back to the resource-limited nature we're in at county levels and individuals. Sometimes we get to where we start to study the armor of the Philistines instead of studying David's sling and stone. We try to mimic the enemy instead of relying on God. And so those are principles, and historically you have that language, and our founding fathers and the establishment of our laws in this country, it's a very similar framework. In the organic nature of things, pretty simple. The problem is we've gotten lazy as people,
yeah.
And our founders were adamant about it. I mean, the only thing, James Madison, one of the main architects of the Constitution, said the Constitution's parchment. The only thing that gives it power is a thorough knowledge of the people. So the more we as a people, individuals, break away from the first principles of good governance, the more we invite a system that lords over us and strips us of self-government.
Yeah, I hope this kind of gives, and okay, so for the people who would maybe go to these meetings, support people who would actually do the heavy lifting, what advice would you give them besides kind of doing their homework?
Well, I will say, in these meetings, like when you're meeting with agencies, obviously I don't, I appreciate this program and things like this I can go on where I can share some of the broader passion, you know, because what I'm talking about from the spiritual side, that's the real motivating factor for me. But when I'm in a procedural type stuff, trying to deal with agency, writing documents or sitting in a meeting, I ordinarily don't make a bunch of theological arguments. But those principles are applied in what I do. So first, be rooted in first principles. Know where you come from as a people. When it comes to engaging on, and maybe we can shift now a little bit in the conversation, winding down this second hour, of getting into a couple case examples of where we, in the last year, working with counties and a couple coalitions, shut down some major regulatory processes that the Biden administration was pushing forward.
Which one do you want to do? I have one on my screen to see if you're reading my mind.
I sent you three items. I'm game with starting with either one. There's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biological diversity rules. There's the U.S. Forest Service old growth amendments that were promulgated. And then there's the National Interest Electric Transmission Corridors that were being pushed through the Bible Belt in Kansas.
I was kind of excited about that one because the energy thing is coming for all of us, and especially what we are learning and have learned recently from you and others about, you know, AI and the draw and all that. So your title on it was Department of Energy Retreats from Several States After Local Opposition. It's like, that's exciting. That's, you know, what can you, what would you like to tell people about that?
Yeah, so for those, for the folks that did listen to the first program, it was the National Interest Electric Transmission Corridor issue. It wasn't that, but that was the second thing that brought the artificial intelligence stuff to my attention. So for those of you who don't know what the National Interest Electric Transmission Corridors are, those are Department of Energy. The Congress back in 2001 authorized Department of Energy under the Federal Power Act to establish national interest electric transmission corridors through the Department of Energy, which is a federal agency, and also provided permitting authorities to FERC. And so after that power was established, Department of Energy went about in the early thousands to establish these national interest electric transmission corridors. And they're not transmission lines. They're corridors that set the boundaries and buffer regions where they can site transmission lines and use the power of eminent domain to build them out. So they tried that back in the early thousands. One of them was a large one through California. They were litigated. And the Ninth Circuit, surprisingly enough, sometimes you get some decisions out of the Ninth Circuit that are halfway decent, and they shut that whole project down. And then it never came back. The National Interest Electric Transmission Corridor never was brought back anywhere. But the other thing the 2001 amendments did is it directed Department of Energy to do every three years they'd publish a needs study where they assess, look back on the grid and assess the congestions and constraints that are being experienced on the grid so that they can plan to increase transmission capacity or whatnot. So people actually, consumers, end use electric consumers actually are, getting, their electricity reliably and affordably. So those needs studies were retroactive, where they looked back in the past and assessed those congestions and constraints. In 2021, the Nancy Pelosi-controlled Congress and the Biden administration in the Jobs and Investments Act amended the Federal Power Act again and gave Department of Energy even broader authority and directed them to project their 3 years needs study into the future. So now, since 2021, and then 2023, Department of Energy published their 3 years needs study, and guess what they found in their publication projecting that forward? We're going to experience massive congestion and constraints on our grid. And why is that? Because the federal government went about to build out all this wind and solar.
Nice.
That's not tied into the grid. So if they were to look retroactively like they did till 2021 and project and look at the past, so what actually happened, 2023, Department of Energy published that report, and they said there's massive congestion and constraint coming to the grid in the future. And what is that being driven by? Renewable energy and AI data centers. And then they put out phase two of their preliminary national interest electric transmission corridor study, and they plotted out massive corridors across Kansas into New Mexico, Nebraska, the Dakotas, one through parts of California, and a couple out on the East Coast as a preliminary map for where these corridors would site or would sit. And like I said earlier, the corridors would allow Department of Energy to site transmission lines. It would allow the federal government to bypass state and local permitting authorities, because traditionally, all through the history of this nation, states and local governments have always wielded eminent domain and transmission siting for those systems and utilities. So we have this huge shift in the federal government with this renewable energy push and Department of Energy with these corridors. So that's the backdrop of how that came about. And Kansas Natural Resource Coalition is a coalition of counties in Kansas, and other counties and commissioners were getting lots of phone calls when this came out, this phase two map, and people were not very happy with what this looked like. So the really neat thing about this is several counties held public meetings and did educational meetings and public meetings and formed their constituency. A white paper was drafted, and I assisted in that, and that was disseminated around the state of Kansas. It was also disseminated to D.C. It was disseminated into some of the surrounding states as well, and we held a briefing call with quite a few commissioners from several other states. Oklahoma, Missouri, New Mexico, and other states came onto that call. We had an hour and a half briefing call where we educated on the issue, what it is, what Department of Energy is pushing, and the problems with it. And not too long after that, the Oklahoma Attorney General started getting involved. I don't know if we contributed to that or not, but long story short is this is an interesting process, because and usually we're submitting substantive documents to these federal agencies in rulemaking. In this case, it was at a preliminary phase. There was no regulatory process in place. And just by local grassroots resistance and education and circulating a white paper and a certain county commissioner and a county attorney getting Department of Energy on the phone and making it very, very clear, because these corridors also would open up billions of dollars of finance through the Inflation Reduction Act. So the county commissioner flat out
told... Let's find out. Hang on to that thought just one second. Let's take a really quick break and come back. I don't want to break that up, but get into how that Inflation Reduction Act was going to feed that and what that was going to do. Because that's obviously not the only place it's happening or going to happen, and that's this kind of stuff I think people need to watch for on the ground and be smart about. So we will be back with our guest, Nathan Deshmaker. And I picked this song because it always reminds me of Nathan. It's kind of long, but you're going to like it. You can hear us at
WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Anytime online.
There you go.
Oh, what I would do to have the kind of strength it takes to stand before a giant. With just a sling and a stone, surrounded by the sound of a thousand warriors, shaking in their armor, wishing they'd have had the strength to stand. But the giants calling out my name and they laughs at me, reminding me of all the times I tried before and failed. The giant keeps on telling me time and time again, boy, you'll never win. You'll never win.
To rewrite that song. We need Weird Al to do a new one for us, because when the lights go down in the city, I don't want to be anywhere near it.
No, no, thank you.
All right. Back to Nathan.
Yeah, just really, I guess I'll just summarize the corridor issue there. What it boiled down to was everything I explained, and then a county and a county attorney getting Department of Energy on the phone and stating pretty plainly that if this is about finance, you better find another way, because we will use coordination and every legal avenue available to us if you put these corridors through our counties to oppose it. So that process happened through last summer in 2024 into the fall. And about a week and a half before Christmas, Department of Energy reached out to the executive director of that coalition of counties and said, we're going to put the notice out next week. We're withdrawing those corridors out of Kansas.
Oh, that's too bad. Can you, hey, Nathan, can you move your microphone just a teensy bit? It's having kind of the foofing sound a little bit.
How about now?
Yeah, that's good. And so talk about the infrastructure, because the Infrastructure Act, I should say, the cannon of money that, you know, has been shot all over the country. What kind of money were they looking at, and how, and had they already applied for it? Was it grants they were going to have to do? What was the mechanism?
Yeah, so I should have that pulled up, but the Jobs and Investments Act opened up several billion dollars.
Okay. I don't remember
the exact number, but it was billions of dollars of finance loans, Department of Energy loans. And the way it was written, too, they're forgivable loans as well. If these entities got into those programs and didn't finish the projects, there was loan forgiveness provisions in statute.
So there is free lunch.
In that body of law. Yep. So Milton Friedman remarked years ago, inflation is a result of inaccurate assessment of the true cost of government policies as much as it is a result of government spending itself. And when the Biden administration and these agencies pushed the wind and solar development and building out, because they also massivized wind and solar buildouts, when they did the assessments, the economic impacts analyses for those, if they even did them, they did not take into consideration and assess the resulting build-out of massive transmission systems to tie those into the grid.
Of course not, because we don't ever think it all the way through before we pull the trigger. And interestingly enough, how much of that has gone out around other... Do you have any idea, like, what a volume of that has gone out around the country that now is going to be this disjointed, just, you know, like our train to nowhere? I think most people have kind of followed that, the slow speed rail that they've, you know, dropped gazillions of dollars into. I couldn't even tell you how much.
Yeah. I don't have a specific number, but the genius, if you want to call it that, behind the Inflation Reduction Act and this Jobs and Investments Act and other laws, but those two primarily, is the Democratic party was able to entrench billions of dollars of renewable energy projects into the hearts and corners of even Republican districts. And that is one of the fights that is now propped up. Because when the Inflation Reduction Act passed, I'm pretty sure there was not a single Republican that voted for it. Every single one opposed it. But the problem with Republicans and conservatives on the ground is sometimes people just go where the money flows. And even Republican districts and others bought into, you know, the grants for building EV charging stations, windmills, solar panels, and all this renewable infrastructure. So now you've entrenched billions of dollars into projects that are either built out or in process of being built out or in the preliminary permitting stages of coming online to allow for the build out. So now the Trump administration has to come into that mess, and the Congress even has to try to deal with that mess. And in my opinion, the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, in its entirety should go away. But there's going to be massive efforts to keep parts of that intact for the particular reason that there's a lot of investments across the country that haven't been realized. But the thing is, though, most of these investments wouldn't have happened in a free market.
See, that's,
it was 100% subsidized.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. It's a little bit, you know, we always go back to Solyndra, right? I think that was our that was our big wake-up call. Like, wait, what? We gave a whole bunch of money to this company that, yeah, it's all kind of Solyndra and then more Solyndra. However, once these communities do sort of get in the grant process, nobody wants to let that go. I know that happened when they said they were putting a pause out. I mean, that made the, you know, phone lines light up in the congressional offices, just to, I think, put it mildly. What about our project? Oh, my God, what about me? It's like, oh, dear. Oh, dear.
Well, right there, though, that's a signal of the fact that we as a people have become dependent.
Yeah.
That's what I tell legislators sometimes when they vote on these handout programs is you need to stop celebrating the 4th of July every time you do that.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I'm kind of chuckling because I have a perfect song for that. I either have a meme for it or a song for it. That's like my answer to everything. I got a meme. I got a song. No, but I don't know how you know, when you get back to the self-reliance, and maybe we should read that in school again. That was an essay that was really important when I was teaching in the 80s. I made every single one of my students read that essay. You know, self-reliance is something that should be a pillar of our republic. I don't know when that stopped, but...
Well, another term is self-determination.
It was the government cheese.
So, self-government, self-determination, self-reliance. Self-determination means, in a civic context, it means the ability for a local political entity to exercise internal governance without external compulsion. And like Montana Constitution, for example, guarantees to the people of Montana a system of self-government. Lots of local county policy guarantee and provide for self-government. But when you become dependent on outside sources and outside influences, you lose self-governance. You know, like our governor, for example, he brags about Montana having a balanced budget and even a surplus, which is great, but at the same time he says that, he's cost-sharing at the tune of millions of dollars deficit spending from the federal treasury that at the end of the day subordinates the state to the federal government. And, you know, there's a lot of benefits with money and cash flows coming into a state maybe, but what's lost, though, is the guarantee of internal self-governance, which is embedded within the original compacts that created the state in the first place. So is that a good trade is the question. Look at public education, for example. I just used this with a friend of mine the other day when we were having this discussion. Public education is another prime example. I'm out in the middle of nowhere where I went to school, Grass Range, and, you know, and I was fortunate because we had, like, local women that cooked for us. We had, like, home-cooked meals most of the time.
That's cool.
But the irony is, nice, because we took federal money, the school, you know, there was, you know, one day a week there was food that wasn't, well, it was cooked by those same ladies, but it was the prepackaged food that the school basically had to, if they wanted to get the federal monies, they had to incorporate a certain amount of that food into the menu. So once a week we had to eat soy burgers, for example.
Yeah.
And so right there's a perfect example. You know, local governments and local people are like, well, if we don't take the money, somebody else will. Well, what do we buy with the money? Is it really worth taking the money if we're going to buy a soy burger to feed our kids in school when we live in cattle country? I'll donate a cow. But what kind of a trade is that even? It's like, well, yeah, the money, it's like when you're told how to use the money in advance and, yeah, and you won't get the money unless you feed a soy burger once a week, that's not a good deal.
No, that is not a good deal. And yet that's a really good analogy for where a lot of this goes. You wind up with programs.
Yeah, you invent the program to get the money.
Kind of.
When you really didn't need the program.
But then what do you do with the people that are working in the program when the funding for the program goes away? Because then those people still need jobs, so you wind up morphing that program into some big long continuation of such that maybe you would never have done because...
Yeah. Well, you always end up paying for it.
Well, if you use if you used your market-driven analogy, is that something that would have come through the free market? Likely not.
Likely not.
Likely not.
Well, why would people in the heart of Montana, where the predominant industry is livestock production, feed their kids a soy burger at school?
Yeah, right.
We don't even have we can't even make a soy burger here.
Was that the day that everybody used to bring their lunch, like from home?
Yeah, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was like, that's bologna sandwich day, because they're going to try to feed us garbage at school again. Yeah, wow.
Well, that was the day I brought a sack lunch.
Yeah, right. That's what I was thinking, like every kid in school goes, ooh, you know, it's soy burger day. And then, you know, you get into that whole thing of, You're not meeting the need of the population. So much of that soy burger stuff, you know, went into your local soy burger landfill. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just crazy. Well, the Infrastructure and Jobs Act was so much money and it was so huge, and so pervasive that pulling that back starts to become a little bit of a challenge. And I think that's what they found was, okay, we're going to stop everything. Okay, well, stopping everything. Everything's big. We could stop part of it. I don't know how that's going to come out, but I do believe we'll do.
Well, it should be a big wake-up call for communities that, hey, we really got dependent on the federal government here. Let's rethink.
I've sat through many public meetings where people have said, hey, this grant money isn't good. I mean, this is obligating us to stuff we don't necessarily want to continue. And once we get in here, how do we get out?
Right.
Because then you need the next thing, because now you have, you've created a whole new, it's more bureaucracy in a lot of cases, not all.
Well, a lot of times that money's all precedented on the first so many years we'll help you pay for it. After that, it's on you. Well, that just means when that money runs out, those programs
are
going to go away.
Let's play a little government cheese and come back with our friend Nathan for the end of the hour. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Give a man a free house and he'll bust out the windows, put his family on food stamps now. He's a big spender, no food on the table, and the bills ain't paid, cause he's spending on cigarettes and PGA. They'll turn us all into beggars, cause they're easier to please. They're feeding our people that government cheese.
All the gold is in a bank in the middle of Beverly Hills in somebody else's name. So if you're dreaming about California, it don't matter at all where you've played before. California's a brand new game.
Isn't that the truth? Oh, so there we go. We got the cap on California and make fun of government cheese. So there you go.
Yeah, it's worth hitting them all.
It's been worth coming in. It's been worth getting out of my sick bay and coming and hanging out with Nathan and Bill and David. Let's include everybody. So Nathan, I can't get past the soy burgers. It's still funny to me. silly and ridiculous. So let's see. Fish and Wildlife surrenders effort to finalize biological integrity, diversity, and environmental health regulations. So for people who don't live in the, you know, in the West or in rural areas, why do they care about that?
So with a lot of people it may not affect, but there's a national wildlife refuge system, and there's, you know, there's not BLM lands in every state or Forest Service lands in every state, but there are refuges administered by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in, I'm pretty sure, every state. Some are bigger than others. We have one in the middle of Montana, 1.1 million acre Charles M. Russell Game Reserve, and that is the cornerstone that a multinational nonprofit is buying out ranches around to tie into that to create a 3.5 million acre conservation reserve. So when the Biden administration started to promulgate regulations to change the way for the refuge system is being managed, we obviously took note of that pretty quickly and engaged on those items, because it affects a lot of counties that surround that refuge, and there's refuges in other states as well. What these policy changes essentially did, well, they did a lot of things, but the key elements is that they prioritized acquisition boundaries where they create buffers around the refuges that authorize the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to buy out the private lands within those buffer regions. And as soon as they acquire those lands, they become a part of the refuge. And U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has a wildlife dominant mission, and all human activity and use is secondary on the refuge system. And so, like, the CMR in Montana, for example, has enjoyed long-established cattle use, animal unit months, on that refuge from the beginning under the Taylor Grazing Act. They have been retiring cattle use and AUMs off the CMR for a long time. These policies would have, regulatory changes would have exacerbated that. In these changes, they defined historical conditions as composition, structure, and function of ecosystems that existed prior to ecological degradation caused by anthropogenic changes. So the whole regulatory priority was pre-human conditions. And the regulations also, under Section 6, Agricultural Uses, states, we prohibit the use of agricultural practices unless they are determined necessary to meet statutory requirements, fulfill refuge purposes, and ensure biological integrity, diversity, and environmental health. So these regulatory changes was a part of the Biden administration's climate change agenda to permanently conserve 30% of lands and waters by 2050 and to shut off access and utilization by egg production in and around the game refuges or the wildlife refuges across the nation. So in Montana, we engaged on those issues because we have a large buffer region they're trying to create around a refuge in southwestern Montana, and that's a 5.7 million acre
holy cow
footprint around a 55,000 acre refuge that they want us to create a buffer that would authorize them to acquire land, the lands within that 5.7 million acre footprint, which, by the way, that acreage is larger than a lot of states.
Yeah.
So
Well,
so a big issue on that front.
I was going to say, when they do that, when they lock up that much land, A, it's no longer public land, so there's a major issue there.
Yeah.
But, you know, what? I don't know the configuration of that ground, but is that just increased fire hazard, no management, all that? Or is that not a factor where you are?
Well, in that case, it was the Missouri Headwaters Conservation Area, which, yeah, there's a ton of, it's a ton of mountainous. I mean, you have the Rocky Mountains through that region. There's large mountain ranges that run through that footprint. There's large valleys. You have, that's the headwaters of the Missouri River. So that, you have the Gallatin, the Madison, the Jefferson, the Ruby River, and a whole large watershed flows out of that part of the state and ultimately into the Missouri River. So it would lead to potential impacts on, for mining, and everything else. And the worst part about it is it authorizes, the purchase of perpetual conservation easements and outright buying the private lands within those boundaries. And like I said, when they buy the land, they either create another refuge out of it or it absorbs into the existing refuge. But the good news is we engaged every step of the way on those items over the last 2-3 years, and it was actually really neat. E&E News, which is a pretty high dollar subscription that a lot of policy think tanks and governors and representatives across the nation subscribe to, and the environmental lobby. Back in March, or maybe it was May, E&E specifically cited one of our county commissioners and the comments that were developed in that article in opposition to this. And this was another thing that before Christmas last year that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service put a notice of withdrawal of the regulatory changes on the Federal Register, and which is really surprising because usually at the tail end of an administration like the Biden administration, they just ram through everything they can.
Right.
And they did that here. They were doing that here, so they took their eye off the ball with you.
Well, they did it all. It's not that they didn't do that. They did that on some other things. They tried it on the sage grouse stuff too, and they got some of those things in place. But for whatever reason, in combination of the work we had done and some others, there was also national pressure as well. There was enough substantive comment and product on their desk that they withdrew that rule. And the other item was the sage grouse that didn't get finalized in Montana. And then the one other thing, the U.S. Fish and, or U.S. Forest Service old growth amendments, Biden administration also set out to amend like 128 forest plans across, I think, 10 states to prioritize old growth forests. And another area that we heavily engaged on, there was coalitions of counties out of New Mexico, Arizona, Montana, and other associations that supported a substantive work document by Boundary Line Foundation, which is an organization that I do work with sometimes and help with research and writing. So we developed a work product for a variety of constituents across multi-states on the old growth forest rule, and that is another one that surprisingly was withdrawn prior to 2025. So those are three items that were, you know, we had a lot of wins under the first go-around with the Trump administration in the first 4 years where we found the Trump administration was very responsive to local governmental input. The Biden administration, we just did what we could to equip the record. We were preparing for litigation if the Biden administration were to continue forward. And I'm sure the fact that Trump was the incumbent president probably contributed a little bit to the withdrawal of these because they knew that was going to be a pressure there too. But it also, I think it speaks to the importance of the work we're doing though, of getting local governments and associations engaged in the rulemaking process with these agencies and calling them out at the forefront.
Yeah.
And then they don't have a streamline to just push it through, and we throw a big wrench in the process and slow it. If we don't stop it altogether, we most definitely feed some bureaucracy into the process, slow it down, and force them to look at things that otherwise they wouldn't consider.
Well, you guys had 54,000 comments, public comment. I mean, that's no small effort.
Well, that wasn't all from us. I mean, there was a lot of other...
No, but on that topic, I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, a whole bunch. So, same with the biological integrity rule. There was a large... And that's what's neat is when I first started doing this work 7-8 years ago, you know, there was some of that going on the conservative front. You know, the environmental lobby is always hammering stuff in these processes. But it's been encouraging to see, you know, that I'm not the only one. Well, the other encouraging thing is when you help counties and help others engage, and then they learn in the process. And then something comes along, and they do something about it, like that county commissioner in Kansas, for example, and other examples, where they're able to handle themselves. You know, they don't always have to call me or whoever they're working with. They start to, and that's my vision. That's my hope in this whole process is doing and putting all the sweat equity in that I have is to hopefully train others up and help others that are a good study to and in elected positions to be able to handle themselves so that when an agency comes in, even though they may not know all the ins and outs of what they're proposing,
right,
a county commissioner that knows his authorities, understands the agency's not being totally transparent necessarily, it's very powerful when commissioners are well positioned and can challenge them right off the gate.
Well, and it's really helpful when the citizens are productive, because it's one thing for everybody to be mad and all that, but that doesn't really move the needle. And people can't – conservatives kind of stink at being mad long term, which is what I kind of like about them. They tend to be mad in spikes, and then they go have a barbecue and everybody kind of gets along again, and that's sometimes where, you know, the left is still grinding its axe in the background slowly, and we're out living our lives, doing our jobs, and we're like, what the hell, they're still mad? Oh my God, they're still working on that? And it kind of catches us still off guard periodically, but there are some things that people have learned to watch for, and one is that when it comes to public meetings that the agencies do at state and federal, both, they'll do these Delphi meetings where you go into the public meeting and either they have you all set up at little tables with post-it notes and you're going to have small group discussion, or you have to walk around a room and meet at little stations so that you can have a person explain to you one little piece of the project. And by separating everybody, there's no group force. And what we have learned, what I've watched over and over is, first thing, there was one that was the best. People went in the room, they saw all the chairs set up in these little tables, they immediately put all the tables, they folded them all up, put them against the wall, took all the chairs, stacked them up, and stood there. And just stood there as a big mass of like 75 people staring these people down, and it was like, game changer.
Yeah.
It was like, our meeting just changed. And it makes it a little less, I don't know, friendly, or it just ungreases the skids, maybe. Skids are still on,
well,
maybe.
Well, the Delphi technique's all about creating consensus.
Right.
And sometimes you can do that and there's some consensus, but when there's a lot of things there's not consensus on. And another thing just to note on that, sometimes, in some cases with counties, we exercise our coordination powers where the county holds the meeting and brings the agency to the table.
Yeah, there you go.
So that changes the dynamics too, is you actually hold the meeting, you take the minutes, you run the agenda, and you put the agency in the chair on the other side. So that's oftentimes very effective as well.
Yeah, sometimes you have to just be a little bit clever and kind of patient, but once people get the hang of it, and they have to show up. I mean, yeah. What kind of a value do you put on the showing up for the public? Like, what's your elevator speech for showing up?
Yeah, it's crucial. The constitutional republic that was drafted by our founding fathers requires citizen involvement and individual people that know their heritage show up and say something. Yeah. You can't be silent.
Yeah, so the old, it doesn't matter, I'm just one person, yada, yada, yada. That, yeah, that just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. It doesn't solve our, problems. And the people that have been elected need your help. You can't just blame them for everything and walk away and expect miracles to occur. Nathan, we have run out of time, believe it or not. We super appreciate you coming on board with us again today. And we hope you have a spectacular time at your new house with all your projects. And we will look forward to seeing you again very soon.
Yep. Thanks for coming on, Nathan.
There we go. Never any rest
Thank
for the wicked.
Grow our trees. We got bills to pay. We got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down. We can't hold back. But you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Until we close our eyes for good.